The Green Front with Betsy Rosenberg, Wednesdays at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Did you feel it? A 4.0 magnitude earthquake hit the Youngstown area.
Oil and gas earthquakes, now in Ohio.
If we started hiring scientists instead of lawyers, we would be able to do our job for the American people.
Well, that didn't take long. A federal panel blocks EPA's new air pollution standards. Big oil cage match as BP sues Halliburton for the Gulf oil spill. Plus,
what we need to do is pass the mother of all repeal bills, and I would begin with the EPA.
Saddle up. We've got what's in store for 2012.
All of that and more straight ahead from BradFlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Global warming is not proven. Second, even if it were proven, there are a lot of different solutions other than cap and trade.
Well, that's funny, Newt Gingrich. You used to be in favor of cap and trade. And what do you mean it's not proven? What are you, a paleontologist or something?
I also am an amateur paleontologist.
Oh, right. And I'm an amateur particle physicist. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Des, Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you, too.
I hope you enjoyed your short but sweet break from the green grid over the past few days.
Yes, and the green news just keeps on coming, Newt Gingrich notwithstanding. And just want to point out that the professional paleontologists really do beg to differ with them.
Okay, well.
Don't quit your day job, Newt.
What day job? Press on.
A whole lot of shaking going on in Youngstown, Ohio.
The whole house shaking. I thought it was going to cave in. The walls were shaking. Windows were shaking. It was really scary.
Ohio state officials have shut down. Four oil and gas injection wells in Youngstown, Ohio, after 11 earthquakes struck the area since the injection wells first opened a year ago. The largest was on New Year's Eve. It measured a 4.0. Seismologists say the earthquakes were, quote, almost certainly caused by the injection wells. Now, these rare Ohio earthquakes are not caused directly by the process of hydraulic fracturing or fracking itself, but by miles-deep underground injection wells where oil and gas companies permanently dump massive amounts of contaminated wastewater after fracking operations are completed. Injection wells and fracking have been linked to a rash of earthquakes in Arkansas, Oklahoma, Colorado, and even Britain.
This is amazing. Of course, the fossil fuel companies all blanket the airwaves with ads saying that fracking is perfectly safe. But before the end of the year, we got confirmed that fracking seems to have poisoned drinking water in Wyoming, and now it's causing earthquakes?
Yep, and Ohio residents might want to consider buying earthquake insurance. French oil company Total on Tuesday announced it will invest $2.3 billion, that's with a B, in Ohio's natural gas fields.
Wow.
The BP oil spill 1 year ago was AP's number one story of the year, which of course ended up being a non-story.
Yeah, Rush, it was such a non-story that BP is now suing Halliburton for $42 billion in damages.
Billion?
Billion with a B in the oil disaster in the Gulf of Mexico. BP is suing Halliburton to recover damages that will cover, they say, all cleanup costs, damages, and lost profits it incurred in cleaning up the 2010 oil spill, the worst in U.S. history, that killed 11 workers. Halliburton's failure to properly cement the well has been identified as the root cause of the disaster.
These standards are 22 years in the making. They have not been a surprise. They are based on technology and science, and we believe based firmly in the law.
That was Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Lisa Jackson at the unveiling of the first ever national standards to reduce toxic mercury pollution emitted by the nation's power plants. And just as Jackson predicted, less than a week later, the pushback from the industry is already underway and has collected its first victory. On Friday, the D.C. Court of Appeals blocked the implementation of a section of the new rules that would restrict air pollution that drifts across state lines. The cross-state air pollution rule would control emissions from power plants in 27 states that the EPA says affects the health of people living downwind. The industry argues the cost of installing modern pollution controls is too expensive and the deadline is too soon.
Good. I'm glad that the courts are finally pushing back against that commie leftist socialist George H.W. Bush, who forced the EPA to put these rules into action 22 years in the making.
Finally, with the end of 2011 came the end of the energy wasting light bulb. Now, of course, you can still buy incandescent bulbs. They'll just be new and innovative and will save you more money and energy.
I don't understand. Fox told me I wasn't going to be able to buy incandescent bulbs anymore.
Yeah, that's why Fox News people don't know what they're talking about. The new light bulbs will also help taxpayers from having to build 30 new power plants in the coming decade.
Job killers.
Also gone with 2011 are federal tax credits for the ethanol industry that Congress declined to renew. Now, looking ahead to 2012, President Obama must make a decision on whether to approve the Keystone XL pipeline within the next 2 months, and agriculture and farm subsidies will expire this year, so Congress will be negotiating a massive billion-dollar farm bill amidst the 2012 insanity circus that we call the presidential election.
For all of those stories and much more that we couldn't get to today, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. You can download us anytime via iTunes, listen to us on your mobile device via Stitcher Radio, and follow us 24/7 on the Twitters at Green News Report. From bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your first of the year Green News Report.
I'm a lover, baby, a whole lot of shaking going on. Yeah, I'm a lover, baby, baby, you can't go wrong.
Whole lot of shaking going on, and from shaky ground to moral ground, that was our friend Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen. They were on the show a couple of weeks back, and I think they do a great job of rounding up the week's green news. They do that a couple of times a week. We'll start with their green news report at the top of our show. See how you like that. You can let me know at Betsy@thegreenfront.com. But now we're going to have a wonderful conversation about our ethical action for a planet in peril. What is our call to action? What is our moral obligation as Americans, as citizens, as earthlings? We're going to find out from one of the editors of a book called Moral Ground, Ethical Action for a Planet in Peril. And Kathleen Dean Moore is joining me now on the Green Front. I am very pleased and honored to have her on. I just became aware of her work last week, and so she's very kind to join us on the Green Front. Thanks for being here, Kathleen.
Thank you for the invitation.
Before I ask you what prompted you to put this wonderful edition together with essays from Desmond Tutu to E.O. Wilson to the Dalai Lama and many, many more very poignant original writings, I wanted to start with a quote from your introduction because it so resonates. You say, "It seems almost as if we were watching a herd of dinosaurs grazing on giant fern trees, oblivious to the shadow of the asteroid that will strike Earth and forever change the conditions under which they will live or die. But there is no reptilian oblivion among the neighbors and the people passing by that you were watching as you wrote the introduction to this book. Scientists have done a heroic job of alerting citizens to the world-altering dangers of cascading extinctions, climate change, and other environmental calamities. People know that we are already approaching tipping points where climate change will trigger irreversible alteration in the conditions under which we will live or die," end quote. Yes, people know, but people are not acting as if they do. We're not acting as if we are in a planetary emergency, and I suspect that is what prompted you to compile these wonderful essays. But give us a little bit more background, if you will. Set the scene for this ambitious work. What prompted it?
Well, we agree that scientists have done a heroic job of warning the world that climate change is real, it's dangerous, and it's upon us. And when people didn't respond, everyone's scratching their heads, thinking, you know, knowledge is enough, if people only knew. But that isn't enough. It isn't enough to know what's going to happen. It's also important to realize that what's about to happen is a moral crisis. It's wrong. It's not just stupid to wreck the world. It's wrong to wreck the world. And what we're trying to do with this book is create a global moral consensus to match the global scientific consensus. We want to show that when you start asking, pardon me, people, moral leaders all around the world, do we have an obligation to the future, that you have a unanimous response. Yes, we have an obligation to the future to make sure that the world that we leave them is as rich in possibilities as our own.
And one of the first contributions, if I may quote again for a moment, one of my heroes, James Gustav Speth, wrote a piece called The Limits of Growth, and he says, "How serious has the threat to the environment become? The human presence is now so large that all we have to do to destroy the planet's climate and ecosystems and leave a ruined world to our children and grandchildren, get this, is to keep doing exactly what we are doing today. With no growth in the human population or the world economy, just continue to release greenhouse gases at current rates, just continue to impoverish ecosystems and release toxic chemicals at current rates, and the world in the latter part of this century will not be fit to live in." I think that's worth quoting. Very powerful words.
Those are terrifying words. And he goes on to say, but of course, we're not going to continue doing exactly as we have been. We're increasing the rate at which we pollute. We're increasing the rate at which we destroy other species. And so we're accelerating the end of the road.
As he says, we've been winning battles here and there, including some very important ones, but we are losing the planet.
He's an important person to listen to, the former dean of the School of Environment at Yale, and I think that that he's telling us something that we should be paying attention here to, that if we value life as it has evolved on Earth, then changing the conditions under which it evolved is a very, very bad idea.
And if I may continue to quote just another moment or two, because I love these sentences here. James Gustin Speth goes on to say, the new environmentalism must embrace a profound challenge to consumerism and commercialism and the lifestyles they offer, a healthy skepticism of growth mania and a redefinition of what society should be striving to grow, a challenge to corporate dominance and a redefinition of the corporation and its goals, a commitment to deep change in both the functioning and reach of the market, and a powerful assault on the anthropocentric and contempocentric values that currently dominate. Contempocentric, yeah, it's a new word for me, but I think it's what's going on today, which is all kinds of a reality crap TV, if you will, pardon the expression, but we're ignoring our eco-reality or our green reality. And he's so right, and I guess the good news, and I should probably have him on the show soon, is that we have this Occupy Wall Street movement, which seems to be doing just what he's saying needs to be done, challenge the status quo.
That's exactly right. He really nailed it, and how inspiring it is to see people echoing that and saying exactly the same things, not just in academic publications, but on the street.
Absolutely. And, I promise, last quote from Dalai Lama. I just love these. He says, we need knowledge to care for ourselves, every part of the earth and life upon it, and all of the future generations as well. This means that education about the environment is of great importance to everyone. Scientific learning and technological progress are essential for improving the quality of life in the modern world. Still, more important is the simple practice of getting to know and better appreciate our natural surroundings and ourselves, whether we are children or adults. If we have a true appreciation for others and resist acting out of ignorance, we will naturally take care of the earth. Wonderfully put. It all begins with us. I guess that's the message here.
Yes, and the Dalai Lama surprised us when he sent that essay in. We expected that he would talk more about compassion, but in fact he issued a very strong warning about the possibility that we will make the earth uninhabitable for human beings.
And he, as many of your essayists have done, go on to say, you know, we must consider, you know, generations to come, and that is, I guess, at the crux of the moral argument. You know, we are already impacting lives, you know, in low-lying island nations in Africa with, you know, worst ever droughts in this country alone, with you know, whole towns being leveled, like Joplin, Missouri, Greensburg, you know, Kansas. It's happening already, and we cannot prove it's climate change, but the intensity of these super destructive storms is growing, not to mention the droughts, the fires we saw in Texas, while the governor of that state, who I guess is about to drop out of the presidential race, Rick Perry, of course, I'm talking about, does not believe in climate change. So let's just for a moment look at the political scene. You wrote this book. The introduction was written in 2010. Here we are, the very beginning of 2012. Ecologically, climatologically, things have become very clear that something is missed, something is wrong. It's not nice to fuel with Mother Nature, as we've been doing. And yet not one of the presidential contenders on the Republican side is talking about climate change or anything to do with our environment. If it comes up at all, it's to dismiss it. What's wrong with this picture?
Everything. You know, Derek Jensen says, you know, if it were aliens who were coming on the planet and doing this, if it were an alien invasion where all these, you know, small green people were running around pouring poisons in the river and killing one out of every 10 species and scraping the tops off the mountains, you know, and injecting carbon dioxide into the air until the climate turns on us, we would have the greatest mobilization in the history of humankind.
I love that. What if it was Iranians or Iraqis? I mean, that's exactly what we're doing here. We're spending all this money instead of spending it to fight climate change.
It's
these wars that make no sense. And our infrastructure is feeling it, and mostly our climate is feeling, and we're feeling it coming back. It's a feedback loop, you know, our continuing to neglect this issue. So, yes, your book is so important, and you're also taking it on the road, the message, you and your co-editor, Michael Nelson. You've been talking to church groups, I understand, perhaps schools, any place where people gather. What kind of response are you getting?
Well, we're getting a very interested response. People come out to talk about what their obligations are to the world and their obligations to the future. And we ask them, we tell them, you know, it's not enough for us to have asked 100 of the world's moral leaders. We need a national, we need a global conversation about what our obligations are. We need to think about the crisis of compassion, the crisis of justice that we're creating with climate change. And they respond very strongly. It's not a common thing in people's lives to have a public discussion about their moral beliefs. That's a challenge for people. But when you ask them what they very much value and what they most deeply believe in, they're happy to talk about that. And then it's a matter of saying, you know, if this is what you value, if this is what you care about, if this is who you are as a moral being, then action on climate change is absolutely inescapable.
And I'm sure it strikes you as just as hypocritic as it strikes me. Hippocratic's first do no harm. This is causing harm. when we hear these politicians talking about family values and morality, the very same ones who are, if they have any position at all on climate change, are going out of their way to arrogantly declare that they don't believe either it's a problem or that man's causing it or that we need to really do anything serious about it. Quite ironic, but a bit tragic as well.
Tragic, ironic, and I think monstrous. You know, they make the claim that we have an obligation to protect children. Well, who is going to be hurt first and most devastatingly by climate change but the children? So hypocritical is exactly right, and it's just it's something that people should be calling them on all the time.
Absolutely. It's not just misguided. I think it's, do you think it's, in the case of Rick Perry, perhaps, you know, funded by the oil industry, the fossil fuel industry, I mean, how can they ignore what 98% of climate scientists are saying? What makes them think they know more? The same was true for the pundits on Fox, by the way. How arrogant, and they do have children, and they're all up there standing behind them on the podium. You want to wring their necks, don't you?
Well, you know, I'm a philosophy professor, so my reaction is to try to parse out the argument, and I think it could be understood this way, that an argument that has a conclusion, we must act on climate change, is going to have two premises, and one of them is going to be factual. Climate change will harm the children, and the other is moral. It's wrong to harm the children. And they can't stay up there and say, oh, I think it's just fine to harm children. So they have to quarrel with the factual premise. They have to say, oh, no, climate change doesn't exist, or it isn't so bad, or we can find some technology to protect us. So I think that it's not surprising that they quarrel with the science. Is what politician is going to stand there and quarrel with the deep-seated moral principle that innocent children ought not to suffer from the wrongdoing of others?
And our friend D.R. Tucker, our Republican climate convert, is friendly with a lot of libertarians, and he has explained their intransigence, their, you know, just a refusal to believe that there might be any role for the government in fighting climate change is just that, because they believe that there's no role for government in anything to acknowledge that we have a planetary crisis. That's very urgent and dire would require them to admit, heaven forbid, there is some role for governments to play in this. How crazy is that, to hang on to your ideology while your planet burns?
Yeah, I think it's a fundamental repudiation of libertarian views of climate change is. This is a problem that we have to address together. This is where democracy ought to be defending the trust, you know, the atmosphere, the land, the trust that we, these wonderful things that we hold in trust for our children. Mm. We can't do it individually, one by one.
Alongside your book, On My Nightstand, is a book by Bill McGuire called 7 Years to Save the Planet, The Questions and the Answers. He's out of Great Britain, and he is an emergency expert, and he is warning people. It's a book, a fabulous book of questions and answers. 7 Years to Save the Planet. So, of course, I looked to see when it was published, 2008.
Oh, boy.
And you hear James Hansen from NASA and other experts say, you know, we've got 10 years to turn it around, but they've been saying this for, you know, 3-4 years now. So we're twiddling while home is burning, wasting precious days and resources. And even since you wrote that introduction, I'm sure you feel that, you know, action has, in a way, not only not been taken on a real national sense. Let's just talk about what's going on in this country, since we have a disproportionate impact on the global ecology with our consumption of resources and our amount of waste per capita. But the things have gotten worse, that there is this denial machine at the Climate Progress. Joe Rome calls it DIC, the Denial Industrial Complex,
oh, right.
Or DIC, as the acronym for this, you know, concerted effort, well-funded, to cast doubt, which apparently is just enough for people who don't want to have the cognitive dissonance that, oh, my gosh, we could be the problem and we must do something about it, and so quickly dismiss it. I mean, in a way, things have gotten worse because we now know it's everywhere. The information is out there, but as you say, what's been missing is the inspiration, the motivation, the morality argument.
Yes, it has got worse. And the other thing we ought to mention here is the empowerment of corporations to influence elections, and that has become even greater than it was before. So, yes, if we have 10 years, 7 years to save the planet, we've used them up pretty much.
Mm. And it's not like this is some experiment that if we goof up, we'll do better next time. This is the future of life on the planet. It's almost absurd, isn't it, when you think about how, and of course my piece of this is there's not one talk show on a mainstream platform in mainstream media anywhere in this country that discusses these issues day in, day out, and that's outrageous too. So out of frustration, I've started America's Green Tea Party for those of us who are steamed that they're playing politics with our planet. Got to do something with all this information, otherwise we implode.
Yeah, well,
and
good
I love
for
what
you.
You're doing.
Yeah,
I
you
love
ask
what...
people. Oh, I love what you're doing. You say to people, why aren't you talking about, you say to politicians, why aren't you talking about climate change? And they say, oh, I can't even say the words. We can't even mention the words anymore. The consequences are so swift. So,
I mean, the
you,
right
Betsy.
Will reject them, and they're the ones who are trying to appeal to the right. What about our president? Do you think President Obama gets it, and do you expect more when he hopefully will win a second term because his Republican opponents refuse to even accept there's a problem, and how can anyone lead in dealing with a planetary emergency if you don't even acknowledge the problem?
I don't
know. At least he's done that, our
yeah.
president.
Yeah, and you know, and one of the things he's very good at is articulating moral arguments. I mean, he's very, very good at saying what he believes is right and then drawing conclusions from that. And so if he does find himself freer than he has been in the past, I think that his natural ability and his moral power, which we were inspired by at one point, will serve him well, will serve all of us well.
Well, let's hope in the second administration he'll get back to his roots, and not only his African-American black roots, but his green roots as well, because we know he really does get it. Unless he's got a really great speechwriter, and he's intelligent. He must get it. How can you not? Let's hope he acts on those words. And then, of course, there's Congress to reckon with. But he, of course, alone has the ability to decide on the future of the Keystone Pipeline. That will, of course, be an indicator of where he's going. I'm speaking with Kathleen Dean Moore. She, along with Michael P. Nelson, are editors of a wonderful book I highly recommend called Moral Ground, Ethical Action for a Planet in Peril. They have dozens of original essays from people like Bill McKibben, Karl Pope, the Dalai Lama, E.O. Wilson, wonderful words of wisdom from people who are, as we are, concerned about where we're going. And I think the moral piece is exactly where I was going with the Green Tea Party. You know, we need to get back to basics here, and I'm inviting mothers to gather to talk about how to green our routine, and who more than parents, you know, understand the connection of generation to generation and the continuation of the human species. Unless I somehow miss the memo and we're giving up on civilization, I think we have an obligation here.
Well, I think you're right, and parents, mothers are absolutely the natural group to speak with, and grandparents too. They're at the point where they have the experience, they have the wealth, they have the time, and they have the caring that they really could make a difference. And
absolutely, and I'm a step-grandmother too, so I shouldn't forget that. I've got a 3-year-old, you know, and just to look into my 17-year-old daughter's eyes, my 3-year-old granddaughter's eyes, you don't have to be a parent or grandparent yourself, but it certainly makes it very, very real, and wondering what kind of future we're leaving behind, certainly an environmental legacy worse than any other in history, certainly worse than what we inherited. That should be a call to action.
It should, and it's what actually called me to action, too. I was playing with my granddaughter. We were reading a story about owls in bed, and we were hooting to each other, and she was laughing and laughing, and I said, you know, that's it. That's it. I will do nothing in my academic life, in my professional life, in my activist life that doesn't make the world safe for the laughter of children and the hooting of owls and these things that cause such great joy and such beauty in the world. And that I think, was a turning point for me.
Mm. And not to mention that you are a philosophy professor, so you're interacting with youth, college students every day.
Yes, and you know, students get it. They are not ignoring this issue. What they are doing is saying, now what can I do? What can I do? What's the first step? And that's what we need to be doing with our, to help our students, is empowering them to make a difference with knowledge, with information, but also with the courage to make a moral argument in public, stand up and say what they really believe in, affirm the principles of justice and compassion.
So they're not only facing a broken economy and a very, very difficult job climate as they get out of school, but also a broken environment. And isn't there an opportunity there? When I speak to high school and college students, I don't say go out and get a green job. I say think about what's needed. This is where you are here now. This is where we need to go to be a sustainable country and planet. And think about whatever it is you're interested in, whether it's law, medicine, media, writing, how you can incorporate a green angle. And I think you should have job security for life if we can wake up the world, you know, quickly enough. So that's how I try to take what is so much negative news into what is truly, as Al Gore says, in every crisis there's an opportunity. I guess the Chinese said that originally, but there's a character that has both meanings in it. And you would have thought, just for a moment to just touch on Al Gore, that incredible milestone of a movie, An Inconvenient Truth, would have awakened the slumbering masses. And it did wake a lot of people up. It informed a lot of people. But, of course, I found that the very people who most would need to see that refused to spend 90 minutes to educate themselves and at least have a, you know, informed opinion on climate change realities. And things have gotten much worse since then and far more graphic.
Yes, you're right. And I think you're absolutely right about what you're telling students, too. I quote Frederick Buechner when students ask me. I say, he said that your calling is at the intersection of your greatest joy and the world's deepest need. And I tell my students, find that joy, and then find that need and go to that place and do that work. I think that's really important for students to realize they do have the passions. There are things that they want to do more than anything else, and the world needs that passion. The job, then, is to just figure out how to make those things come together.
And we need to figure out how to monetize those things, because I've been following my passion for 15 years, as a few others I know, trying to make it as a green media source, and the corporations have not quite gotten behind it. Certainly the syndicators of America are in the dark ages, I can tell you from personal experience, so that needs to change too. That's a positive note, not a negative note. It's just stating a need if we can really reach people where they live and connect the dots for more Americans, and what is it they love? If it's not their kid, it's their country, it's their community, it's their park, it's their, you know, local natural resources, it's all threatened on a planet that can't sustain us. And to just remind people that we are an integral part of nature. And if anyone thinks we don't need nature, you know, try going without breathing, for starters.
Well, that's the right question. What do you love? And then the second question is, what does it mean to love something? It doesn't mean to just, you know, dance around with some kind of joy in the presence of that thing. It means to work hard and commit your life to its thriving, to absolutely, maybe tragically, but without any hesitation, defend it against its enemies.
And as I said that, you know, the need for more people to realize what's at stake. I mean, by the same argument, your book should be a New York Times bestseller. Has it reached the bestseller list yet? And probably you're just trying to get word out about it. And, of course, the demand has to be there. And that's where, you know, we need to turn things around.
Thank you. No, it hasn't reached the bestseller list. We are, we do have a paperback, and we're hoping that it starts getting into classrooms, because that's where we think that students need to understand the moral dimensions of the crisis.
Well, it'd be a perfect classroom reader, because it is intellectually, morally, spiritually, you know, encompassing the greatest challenge of our time, and you really have a great compilation of contributors. How long did it take to get all these together?
It was about a two-year project. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we felt the urgency of it, so we didn't give people very much time to respond. Everyone understands that this has to happen, that our changes have to happen quickly. So it was a faster process than most books would be.
Mm. And how can you get that conversation going where you and Michael have been speaking to the public across the country? Are you trying to get are you training people to conduct study groups? Because I do think that's the way to reach people, it seems, is if we can't do it, you know, through mass media, then face-to-face. It would seem to me, I'm also sharing your sense of urgency, and it seems most efficient to do it through broadcasting or the Internet. But it seems that change happens when people see their friends and neighbors and family members changing and talking about these issues.
And talking about them is what's important, to stand up straight and say, this is, I affirm my moral obligation to take action. We have, this summer we put together a moralgroundteaching.com website where we have discussion questions and directions for leading discussions based on the book. So that if a person does want to gather their friends or their church group or any other group together for conversations, there's all kinds of ideas about how they might do that. So that's what we're trying to do next, is get materials out to people so that it's not just Michael and I who are calling people together, but so that everybody is empowered to call people together for this discussion, because it's this discourse that has to happen. It's a conversation about our obligations that I think has to happen.
And many of my peers, fellow parents, say, well, our kids are going to have to deal with this. Like, it's too late for us. And I say, first of all, these are the same people who are taking every kind of longevity potion and exercising every day so they can live forever. If we're in our 40s and 50s and even 60s, we still have several decades, many more hopefully, we like to think, ahead of us. And our consumer choices every day, our moral choices, can make a difference. And I don't think it's okay to let ourselves off the hook, we baby boomers, when the mountain is getting ever higher.
No, it's true what you say. The question is, our children will have to deal with this, that's sure, so let the children deal with it. But are we going to give them a chance to deal with solutions? Are we going to give them a chance to deal with ways of preventing problems? Or are what we're going to say is, you can deal with the floods, you can deal with those stronger winds, you can deal with famine, you can deal with new disease vectors. What kind of a message is that?
Not to mention mercury and everything from our fish to, breast milk.
Yeah.
Just, everyday impacts on our health because of what we're doing to our environment, which goes from out there to in here as soon as we ingest something, whether it's food, water, or air. Those connections would seem to be obvious, but you would not know it if you just watch the, political debates, what's going on in Congress. Maybe things have to get so bad before they get better, and maybe that's what 2012 will be about, is the paradigm shift, or the shift hitting the fan that really needs to happen.
It's a paradox, isn't it, that much of what we're doing to destroy the planet, we're doing in the name of the children. We want to have the most wealth to protect our children. We want to give them wonderful TVs and wonderful cars. We want to give them futures. We want to give them trust funds. And in the process, we're forgetting that whatever's left of the world is what they're going to have to live in. And that says nothing about underprivileged children. But even those of us whose children are very privileged are being damaged tragically and paradoxically by our efforts to make it good for them.
I see you have a contribution from Thomas Friedman. I just found that entitled Who We Really Are. He's done a lot to, being a columnist in the New York Times on Sunday, write about energy issues and environmental issues. What was his contribution about?
He quoted Severin Suzuki at the Rio conference back in 1992, and you remember this as a young girl who stood up in front of all those diplomats and delegates and gave a talk that brought them to tears, and her basic message is...
David Suzuki's daughter, this is a Canadian environmentalist.
Yes, her message is, you're deciding what kind of world we're growing up in, and parents should be able to comfort their children by saying everything's going to be all right, and it's not the end of the world. But she said, I don't think you can say that to us anymore. She says, my dad always says, you are what you do, not what you say. Well, what you do makes me cry at night.
Wow. I'll have to get a copy of that speech, and I wonder what she's doing now. I'm sure, given what she knew at a young age, working somewhere in consciousness raising as a social change agent. I regularly find myself apologizing to my daughter as she overhears me having conversations about, dire consequences of continued lack of awareness as we watch what's going on television. And it breaks my heart, and at least I'm doing something about it, but it's, of course, not enough. And that's really what's, frustrating, is if every American or every American who could, and I'm talking about people who have the ability to put a little bit of time and put a little money and educate themselves, we really need all hands on deck, and yet that's not happening yet.
No, you're absolutely right. And I sure hope you're wrong about the one thing that's going to make it happen is some sort of, it has to get worse before we can get better. I hope that's not the case. Because how much worse can it get before we can't recover from it?
And that's my line, too. And for 15 years, I've been covering the Green Beat. You know, people would say to me, no one's going to pay attention until there's a crisis. And I would go on to list, you know, what's going on with our forests, with our oceans, with species, with the climate. And yet that wasn't enough. And then we saw 2 years ago worldwide weather going wacky. And then in the last year, of course, in our own country, not to mention the BP disaster, the Japanese disaster, the coal mine disaster. I mean, if nothing else, we should see that human error is a problem, and that things can very quickly go from normal to dark and ugly and scary.
We protect ourselves as well as we can from so many risks. You know, we all have car insurance and liability insurance and all that, but the great underlying, the mother of all risks, we're not addressing.
Exactly. Mother Earth, and also the mother of all problems, the great exacerbator, as someone said, Larry Brilliant of Google, to quote him, that's what climate change is. You know, it will impact everything from the oceans to species to our weather, and it is a delicate balance. And, you know, on Fox News, they're still spewing garbage when it snows heavily, like last year on the East Coast, you know, that you know, mocking Al Gore and climate change, when if they just took a few minutes or hours, if they really want to delve deep, to see that this is exactly the kind of weather extremes that's been predicted. I mean, that kind of ignorance shouldn't be tolerated anymore, especially by people who are making, you know, millions of dollars to be on nationwide television every night.
No, I agree with you, and it just goes to show how it may not be a disaster that changes the course of history, because we can always deny the cause of the disaster.
Well, we can't, but they can. And yeah. Down with the deniosaurs, as I say. We just have a couple of minutes, Kathleen. Any parting thoughts as we begin a new year?
Well, I like to end on some sort of a happy note. We don't want to break people's hearts. We don't want them to give up acting. Certainly there are reasons to think that we don't have much hope that we'll turn it around, but that doesn't mean we have to abdicate our moral responsibility, because between hope and despair, there's this huge ground called moral integrity, where we are called to act in ways that are consistent with what we believe is right, and where we're called to make thriving those things that we love. So we can set aside hope, we can set aside despair, and we can determine that no one's going to make us into instruments of destruction, that we will live our lives as if they were works of art that embody our deepest values. And I think that's what each of us individually is called to do.
And maybe the green lining in the cloud is, you know, that we can get people to connect around this and rebuild community, because that, of course, is a third issue, not only a broken economy and environment, but the isolation of people who are, you know, living farther from family, perhaps not having children, and feeling, you know, connected only, you know, through our technology, our gadgets, but not having, you know, those same face-to-face gatherings that are so critical to our sense of belonging and purpose.
No question, there are many, many green linings in this. This is our chance to start over and get it right this time. This is where we can really call on our moral imagination to imagine new ways of living that are consistent with what we care about, that are joyous, that are sustainable, that are respectful. So, yes, there are many reasons to think that this is a time of challenge that we are capable of meeting.
Mm. I love that. And I hope that you are taking your show on the road, so to speak, and reaching as many audiences as you can. If you need anyone in California, I'd love to maybe partner with you, because this is exactly where the rubber meets the road for me, too. I think it really does come down to a moral question. And with the Green Tea Party, that's really what this is all about. And I happen to be Jewish, and we have something called Tikkun Olam, which is Hebrew for healing of the world, and we are required to do that, to engage in that on a regular basis. So I've started having Green Tea Kun Olam parties at synagogues and sisterhood gatherings, because, you know, we all, of whatever religion we are, whatever our spiritual bent, you know, we are all called to act not tomorrow but today.
That is so true, and that's one of the messages that we got from all these people all around the world. No matter what worldview you bring to this problem, the answer is the same. We have an obligation to the future.
Wonderful, and thank you so much for your contribution to this, Kathleen. I really appreciate your being with us, and I'm glad that the students at Oregon State have you to inspire them and inform them. And I do think it does take that combination of inspiration and information, that motivation, that maybe it's that juice, that missing piece or part that really brings together everything that we're hearing about and really is a call to action, because people on some level know what's going on and what we're dealing with, and suppressing and sublimating, you know, takes a lot of energy, and, you know, to really tell it like it is and speak, put words to what we're facing as far as a challenge, it's only then that we can then make that eco U-turn and start, you know, the repair. And I'm sure you agree with that, and thank you so much for your contribution to this very important challenge.
Thank you, Betsy, and thank you for your good work.
Thank you. Moral Ground, Ethical Action for a Planet in Peril. I highly recommend that book. There's a wonderful foreword by Desmond Tutu. It's a compelling read. So pick it up and read a little bit each day. Share it with people, your family, if you're a teacher, certainly. Bring it into the classroom. It's really one of the better books I've seen, and I like to get my hands on all those great green books. When we come back, we're going to shift from ethics to eating, and, of course, with a green tint, eco-tensils. Find out what that's all about. One hint is compostable tasting spoons, so we don't have to have those little plastic ice cream tasting spoons littering the landfill forever. When we come back, we'll speak with the founder of that innovative product and company. Peggy Cross will be with us.
Do you want to know the latest news or upcoming events? Follow us at Twitter at PRN_radio or click the Twitter icon on our homepage. You can also friend us on Facebook. Just search Progressive Radio Network. Always new and up to date. The Progressive Radio Network, your home for thoughtful and informative information.
We are the music makers, and we are the dreamers of the dreams.
My name is Rachel Trachtenberg.
And I'm Julia Cummings.
Our show, Pure Imagination, is on every Friday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time. Join us each week for the latest in arts, music, politics, through the perspective of conscious teens. If you miss a show, you can always check out our archives at prn.fm. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
This is Glenn Ford.
And Nellie Bailey of Black Agenda Radio.
It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left.
Listen to us every Monday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time, or download our show anytime from the archives on PRN.FM.
The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward. We hope you're coming with us.
Oh, Jeff.
Yes, Lee?
I just want you to know.
What?
You occupy my heart.
Aw.
Cheater on the Roof with Jeff Chrysler
and Lee Papa.
Thursdays, 8 p.m. Eastern.
Check out our old shows on the archives.
Archives?
That sounds like some weird yellow moldy paper stuff.
And you can listen to all of our old moldy shows at PRN.FM.
Did you hear the Progressive Radio Network has a new slogan?
It does.
It does. Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you are coming with us.
That sounds sort of progressive.
It does, it does, but I think it needs to be a little more demanding.
Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we want you to come
with us.
This is the number one radio station for progressive independent thinkers, the Progressive Radio Network.